I object!
And why is that, Mr. Reed?
Because it's devastating to my case!
I did, you know, the murders, but as you're all so looking forward to this, I thought I'd plead not guilty. Oh.
They say a man who represents himself as a fool for a client. Well, with God as my witness, I am that fool.
Mr. Simpson, this is the most blatant case of fraudulent advertising since my suit against the film The Neverending Story.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 163. I'm your host, Thomas Smith. That over there is your lawyerly host, Andrew Torres. How you doing, Andrew Torres Esquire?
I'm great, Thomas. How are you?
Doing well. Very interesting episode today. I can't wait. We are going to talk about, a lot of people saw, of course, on John Oliver and elsewhere, the Sinclair Broadcasting Group. We're going to talk about that contract and how it is that they're able to do that. It's very creepy. So we'll get into that. And we're going to talk about the Cloud Atlas. No, sorry. The Cloud. We're finally doing a Cloud Atlas episode. No, not really. The Cloud Act is something that sounds very ominous. And I'm interested to hear what Andrew has to say. It involves being able to get data from foreign places and have other countries get data from us in weird ways that sounds creepy and scary. So we're going to hear about that. And then we're going to round it out with a really interesting WWE related listener question. How about it? What do you say? Ready to go?
I'm ready to go.
Unfortunately, some members of the media.
Some members of the media.
Some members of the media.
Some members of the media use their platforms to push their own personal agenda.
So what's going on? How are the people have seen the it's not funny, actually. It's funny, but it's not funny. It's creepy and horrifying and scary that this one broadcasting company is able to get all these local news anchors to read their propaganda, essentially. And you've seen the videos, likely, or you can see the video. Maybe we'll link them or something, of all of these different local newscasters reading the same statement, prepared statement, like we're in, freaking North Korea, about fake news and all this stuff. It's scary, but what's going on? You want to talk about how they're able to do that and that sort of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I'm going to link the video that was first compiled by Deadspin. Someone over there noticed that an awful lot of local news broadcasts were opining on editorials that sounded pretty similar. And so when you watch the videos, it begins with one, and then it multi-screens out until you have 36 on the screen simultaneously of these local news anchors, giving this impassioned plea about, fake news and sharing it out. And it's a pro-Trump piece of propaganda, and they're reading it word for word. But of course, they're not disclosing that they're reading it word for word. It's supposed to be, trusted local news.
And that's the thing. You expect this from Fox News. You expect it. Right. And, we'll both sides it and say, when you're watching MSNBC, what you're watching. But like local news, you're not expecting local news to be a propaganda outlet. Like you're just expecting it to tell you some horrible crap that happened near you that you don't really need to know about and will ruin your day.
Yeah. And the reason that this is possible is because the Sinclair Broadcast Group, based here in Maryland, by the way, owns 193 television stations, and they have a pending deal to acquire the Tribune Media Company, which will give them another 40 television stations, Jeez. Including TBS. I mean, it is, you know, we talked about monopolistic practices under the Trump administration, and we talked about, you know, how Trump is getting involved in the Time Warner AT&T merger. There has been no indication that Trump's FTC intends to get involved in the Sinclair and Tribune merger, which would put them in a position that, you know, I would describe as monopolistic. But in any event, right? So Sinclair owns almost 200 TV stations, and that's how they were able to disseminate out the script. In the wake of the Deadspin article, a lot of people ask themselves, why are these local anchors going along with this kind of North Korea? Like, cause you know, like, and I expected the answer to that to be, well, you know, like, look, it's always a challenge when you force somebody to choose between, you know, their integrity, their political belief, and their job, right?
Like, yeah, you know, I can sympathize with that. That's got to be a probably pretty competitive environment, I'm sure. And you know, your employer tells you to do something, you know, I can certainly sympathize with that. I mean, it seems like if you don't do it, they'll just replace you, you know, and it's not like you'll single-handedly bring them down or something. So I can understand the thinking that would go into that.
Yep. But as it turns out, there is a much more sinister and law-based explanation for this. And this has to do with provisions of the contract that have been leaked. As far as I can tell, the entire contract is not anywhere online. I searched at considerable length to find this. I'm going to link some screens from reporter Matt Pierce. But in section 8.1, of the standard Sinclair Broadcast Group contract is the provision on termination, right? And it says, you know, that the employee can, you know, terminate his contract, which, you know, you can, in other words, you can resign. We do not know if you resign to what extent they have non-compete agreements, right, that would prevent you from going to a rival channel, right?
Yeah.
So if you're, if there are only three local news stations in town and, you know, you're prohibited from going to the other two for 2 years, that may be a serious disincentive. But a far more relevant effect at the moment is subsection C, which says, in consideration of employer's expenditure of considerable money, time, and effort in training, promoting, and assimilating the employee into employer's business and operations, employee agrees that if employee voluntarily terminates this agreement, and then there's some other stuff, but that's the critical part, employee will immediately pay to employer as liquidated damages and not as a penalty, an amount equal to 40% of employees' then annual compensation multiplied by a percentage equal to the greater of 25% or the percentage of the current contract year remaining after such termination. So let's break down right numerically what that means. That means if you quit, this provision says you are required to immediately turn over as damages to Sinclair Group a lump sum equal to 40% of your yearly compensation times at least one quarter or times the amount that's remaining on your contract. So if it's April, three quarters of the year remaining on your contract, let's just say then it would be 40% times 75%. So 30% of your annual salary immediately upon resignation.
I mean, that's a ton of money to have to fork over.
Of course, that's a ton of money.
So is this legal though? I mean, they can do that? Is that a good provision of a contract?
I do not believe that this provision is remotely enforceable.
And so, but
look, this is an area we've talked about this before. You know, one of the areas that you see this happen a lot is you see it happen in lease contracts, right? You know, you've rented an apartment in Manhattan and you've signed a 2-year lease and it says, if you leave at any time, then we can accelerate the entire balance of the lease and you'll owe us, you know, $40,000. And people sometimes stay in leases or negotiate large settlements to get out because they look at it and they think, well, yeah, I signed the paper and it said X, but in a place like Manhattan, right, where the occupancy rate is about 100%, a provision like that is not enforceable. It's enforceable, but it's subject to a duty to mitigate damages on behalf of the landlord, such that if they can turn around and re-rent the premises after a month, then you might owe a month's rent for terminating your lease early, but you're not going to owe 2 years of damages accelerated forward. But people don't know that.
Scares people into it.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And let me add, I need to add the huge caveat right here. Don't take legal advice from a podcast. If you are thinking about breaching your lease, talk to a lawyer, right? Because your local situation. It's why I'm using Manhattan as the example there. Your local scenario may be very different. And, you know, if you live in Pocatello, Idaho, you may owe the whole 2 years, right? So I'm not trying to suggest everybody go out there and violate their leases. What I am saying is that even when a provision, the general provision of even when a term in a contract may not be enforceable as written, it may have a deterrent effect on people. And I think people look at this provision in their contract and it has an enormous deterrent effect on them because they look at it and go, gosh, you know, this big company is going to come after me and they're going to have a facially valid claim for, you know, tens of thousands of dollars. And, you know, and I looked at, you know, so your local news anchors, you know, who may make, you know, $100,000 a year, that to turn around and say, okay, well, you've got to pay $30,000 because you quit in a lump sum. Very few people who make $100,000 a year can afford to write a $30,000 check.
Yeah, right? Okay.
And so it is a tremendous disincentive. What I want to say to people in a situation that are looking at a liquidated damages clause like this in their contracts is that the longstanding rule in contracts, and by longstanding, I mean this goes back to 15th century England.
Yeah.
Okay. It predates the founding of this country by hundreds of years, is that when you have a liquidated damages clause, and a liquidated damages clause is something that says if you breach this agreement, you owe us a certain sum of money, right? We talked about that in connection with Stormy Daniels, right? It says if you breach the agreement and disclose, you owe us $1 million per violation. The scrutiny that's applied is the following general principle, okay, which is, and here I'm just going to read, this is from the Restatement of Contracts, for an executory agreement fixing damages in case of breach to be enforceable, it must constitute a reasonable forecast of the provable injury resulting from the breach.
Right.
Otherwise, the clause will be unenforceable as a penalty and the non-breaching party will be limited to conventional measures of damages. And that absolutely is the touchstone. That's why you see that little parenthetical as damages and not as a penalty. But I do not think that that single line in a form contract prepared by your employer and therefore strictly construed against the employer is likely to prevail over common sense if this provision were to be litigated.
Well, yeah. And if it were, I mean, how much could, because wasn't it for training and stuff like
yeah,
that?
Yeah. Right.
I mean, that's way too much, I would think.
So, well, but, and so that's the point, right? Like if you quit on your employer, right, and you've breached the contract, they may be able to recover their actual damages resulting from your breach, right? But this says rather than determine what that is, they're entitled to this lump sum amount, which is, you know, fixed by the equation, 40% of your salary times the balance of your contract remaining, a balance not to dip below 25%. So you always owe at least 10% of your contract, even if you quit on December 30th, right? Even if you quit with one day left. I cannot imagine. And again, you're talking about a reasonableness inquiry. I think virtually every court in the country, virtually every judge that would encounter a provision like this would say, no, that's clearly punitive. This is not meant to estimate the damages being suffered by Sinclair Broadcast Group. This is meant to penalize and to intimidate employees into staying in their contract. And as you might imagine, it's part of why I led off with the apartment lease example, right? The reason why in major metropolitan areas we have a duty to mitigate damages on behalf of landlords is because we don't want to create the perverse incentives for apartments to go unrented while right. there are homeless people, right? Like, yeah, you want in a city with over 100% occupancy, you don't want to say, the landlord can recoup 100% of the rent and then not bother re-renting it, right? Mm-hmm. So That's a compelling public interest to not make people homeless or to, you know, make sure that people have a place to live. Similarly, courts uniformly and courts in red states as well as blue states have said people working for a living is a compelling public interest, right? And so, you know, the notion that you would enforce a clause, the net effect of which is to coerce people into staying at jobs that they would rather leave in this situation, I think weighs strongly against any possible inference in favor of this clause being a legitimate measure of damages rather than a punitive deterrent measure. But
can we do with this information, really?
Well,
can we send it to your Sinclair Broadcasting employee friend?
Yeah, I mean, people are talking about it, and the problem is, and let's be 100% clear about this. I am saying, in my judgment, that, and again, don't take legal advice from a podcast. I'm saying that in my judgment, if you were a Sinclair employee and you quit and you refused to pay this liquidated damages termination provision, that I think you would eventually prevail in court.
Right, but that's a whole that
is,
ordeal.
Yeah, that is not to say I think it is also highly likely that Sinclair Broadcast Group would sue you.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you're stuck in this place of, you know, having a provision that is very likely unenforceable, but now, you know, you've got to spend your, you know, actual hard-earned money to defend yourself in court where it's not a frivolous argument, right? Like, I mean, the words say they're entitled to the money. You have to carry the burden of proving that it's unenforceable. I think you will, but that's going to require lawyer time, which means requiring money. So it really does suck.
Man, John Oliver needs to get on this. He needs to start like a fund or something. And then the thing is, like, even if they all quit, it's not going to matter. You know, like, there's still the professional pressure of, you quit, we'll replace you. Like, that's still, I mean, I guess if a million of them walked out, it would make a statement, but I don't know. This is frustrating. It feels a little helpless.
It feels like the solution is maybe we shouldn't have one company own over 200 television stations that, you know, penetrate into 40% of the households in the United States.
Yeah.
Maybe that would be a good thing. You know, I think there was something about Hillary Clinton's emails. So there we stand.
But coal miners need to, whatever. Yep. All right. Thanks for that depressing breakdown. as usual, you know, we have the facts on our side, but it's just doesn't matter because it costs so much to evaluate the facts in court and all that it will probably drive people to not want to try that. So, oh well. Andrew, you watched the film Cloud Atlas, and no, this is a stupid joke. I don't know why I keep doing that. I just keep seeing Cloud Act written in our notes. The Cloud Act, what is it? It's not a Tom Hanks movie, you're saying.
No. it's far darker than the usual Tom Hanks movie.
To be fair, though, so is Cloud Atlas.
Yeah, well, I haven't seen it. So as we've said, I know only about the Cloud Act. I do not know about any other clouds. I don't even know what, you know, cumulus clouds are. So before I talk about the Cloud Act itself, I want to take us in our limited use time machine back to December of 2013, the glory days gone by. And what is currently happening is that there is an ongoing criminal investigation into drug trafficking. And the district attorney goes to a magistrate judge in the Southern District of New York and procures a search warrant under a 1986 law called the Stored Communications Act. And again, 1986, right? So stored communications meant 5 1/4 floppy disks at the time.
Megabyte. No, maybe not even that.
Very few computers. Yeah.
Yeah. Kilobytes.
Yeah. It was measured in kilobytes. The standard computer in 1986 is the IBM PC-AT, which shipped with 512K of RAM, which that's not at all from my notes. That's just off the top of my head. Anyway, right. So Stored Communications Act of 1986 and went to a judge and said, what we want is a search warrant that requires Microsoft to produce emails and information associated with a Microsoft account that was relevant to this drug trafficking investigation. And so the emails, however, were stored on a Microsoft server that was located in Dublin, Ireland. So what Microsoft did was they turned over the information related to the US account that was kept in the United States. But then they didn't turn over the emails from Ireland. They said, look, this is a United States judge issuing a US-based subpoena for data that is located out of the country, and under ordinary legal principles, the U.S. law ends at the U.S. border, right?
Makes sense.
And so then they moved to vacate the warrant, right? To have a court declare that the warrant was invalid. And a federal judge disagreed and said, nope, you've got to turn over the emails because the operation of the SCA is such that it contains within the text of the legislation subpoena power, and subpoena power can ordinarily require you to produce all documents that are within your possession, custody, or control. And so even though the stuff was located overseas, it was still within Microsoft's control, and so they could produce it. So they had to produce it, right? Microsoft appealed to the Second Circuit Court of Appeal, and the Second Circuit reversed, and they said, no, Microsoft was correct. The SCA was meant to apply within the domestic United States. Only the language in the decision was only within the territorial jurisdiction of the United States. And then the government moved for rehearing en banc. And the Second Circuit split. So it was a 3-judge panel, ruled in favor of Microsoft and reversed the district court's holding. And then the government moved for a rehearing en banc, the full Second Circuit. That was granted. The Second Circuit split 4-4. And so because they split 4-4, that left the panel decision that we just described in place. 1986 is the passage of the SCA. 2013 is when the government issues the subpoena. 2014 is when the district court says, yes, Microsoft has to turn over. Microsoft appeals. 2016 is when the Second Circuit says, no, Microsoft does not have to turn this over. Then the federal government moves for rehearing en banc. The Second Circuit splits. That leaves the panel decision in place. So the federal government appeals to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court grants certiorari and, in fact, hears oral argument at the end of February of 2018. So this case has been briefed and has been argued before the Supreme Court. Now, with that in mind, what happened after February? In March, Congress passed the omnibus spending bill, right? And attached to the omnibus spending bill is a piece of legislation called the Cloud Act. I will tell you that the Cloud Act had the support of Microsoft and Apple, as well as the Trump administration. What does the Cloud Act do? It moots the US v. Microsoft decision. And by rendering it moot, I mean the government has filed a motion to dismiss the pending case before the Supreme Court as moot, to which Microsoft has joined, right? So in other words, now the government and Microsoft both agree that this act supersedes, and this act does, in broad language, it does two things. So number one, it requires companies that are doing business in the United States that are the subject to a valid warrant to turn over responsive data, regardless of where the data is stored. That's why it moots the government's appeal in US v. Microsoft to the Supreme Court, because it's very, very clear. What they did, by the way, was once this act passed, the government got a warrant pursuant to the Cloud Act for the data on the Dublin servers. And Microsoft, I don't know on a practical basis if they have turned over that data, but Microsoft agrees that under the Cloud Act, they are now required to turn over the data, and has taken the position that they don't intend to contest that. So it clarifies the standard for purposes of search warrants, valid search warrants that request data from companies doing business in the United States, that requires them to produce information, even if the information is stored overseas. And even if the information is not a US citizen's information. So in other words, it's an extraterritorial statute.
Interesting.
And the flip side of that is also correct. In order to foster international cooperation on the exchange of information for criminal investigations that may involve internationally stored information, it allows foreign nations to request information that is stored in the United States and provides that they may engage in their courts may order warrants, including wiretapping warrants, that will produce information from U.S. companies without obtaining a warrant in the United States, right? So it's the inverse of that situation. It strikes home a bit more when you think about it that way, because obviously there are numerous countries that don't have anything like our Fourth Amendment's guarantee on warrant requirements against searches and seizures. And now there is a backdoor for foreign governments that have lesser standards to, under their local standards, nevertheless get at your data here in the United States. And the third part, and again, this part is speculative, so I want to be clear, but it is speculative but authorized. It provides that the president can enter into what are called executive agreements that allow law enforcement agencies in other countries to collect data in the United States while ignoring U.S. privacy laws. So a lot of people are freaking out about this. And usually, you know, we kind of jump in to sort of, you know, be the voice of caution and to say, you know, hey, look, you know, this is overstated. This is overblown. It is not overstated. It is not overblown. It absolutely is intended to extend the ambit of data collection extraterritorially outside of the United States and provides for the reciprocal collection and cooperation with, you know, foreign law enforcement into the United States. Now, look, you can make an argument that's a good thing. Right. Like you could absolutely make the argument that says what we don't want to have happen is we do not want multinational corporations to be able to take something and shield it from the ambit of U.S. Investigations simply because the data happens to be stored on a server that's located on a farm in Dublin. And so, you know, this poses sort of, I think, an interesting question for our listeners on the left who are really, really pro internet freedom, right? But are also really, really skeptical about the power of multinational corporations. You could certainly argue that this, you know, closes a loophole, right? And that if Microsoft has the data, right, why does it matter which server farm that it goes to, you know? So I want to give voice to that. But I want to say that those who have described the Cloud Act as far-reaching and expansive in terms of authorizing government data collection powers, that description is correct. And obviously that does not even begin to get into, you know, why was this piece of legislation appended to an omnibus spending bill when it, you know, has absolutely nothing to do with the subject matter of, you know, that was the part of that spending. All right, this is not authorizing new spending in connection with data collection. This is setting new standards, and kind of seems like the thing that you might want to have a public debate on. Like, I think it would be really interesting to have that public debate, right? Like, you would see an interesting alignment of folks, right? Like, you would see the business interests, you would see sort of the pro-privacy interests, you would see the anti-corporate interests, you would see, you know, the internationalist interests, right? Like, that, it I don't know that this would necessarily break down on traditional Democratic Republican lines because of all of that, but we didn't get that.
Well, what's a couple questions, I guess. A, they're allowed to do this under the omnibus spending bill, right? It's not like they're not allowed to do it. It's just, it's kind of a crappy thing for them to do, you know, blend it in kind of with a bunch of other stuff.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
It's not as though it's against any rules or anything like that.
Nope. It does not violate any internal procedures. And there's no ability for a private citizen to bring a lawsuit that challenges it.
Gotcha. And then I'm wondering now, is there a reason why they have to have this be a sort of both sides-y revolving door thingy? Like, I don't, it might sound unfair, but just hypothetically, would we have been able to say, all right, we've got the ability to access that data if it's stored, no matter where it's stored, but we're not going to grant other governments the right to do that to us. Would they have been able to? Is there any reason? I guess other governments might have a problem with it, but we could have passed that bill, right?
Yes, we could have passed that bill. The reason why they didn't pass that bill is, I would spin it out this way. If you pass a bill that just expands the extraterritoriality of the U.S. statute without giving foreign governments an incentive to cooperate in return, then what you could have is conflicting rulings, right? Like, Microsoft could go to an Irish court and say, I want an injunction in Ireland blocking me from turning over this data to the United States, and you would have, you know, a conflict of laws where you would have a valid U.S. warrant ordering them to turn over the data, and then you would have a foreign injunction against the United States government ordering them not to collect the data, right? So, you know, it would potentially cause that kind of uncertainty and confusion.
Then you got a war.
Yeah. No. No, what is
that? Probably a trade war.
It would put Microsoft in this sort of tug of war position. And it is very, very clear that the question I thought you might ask is,
well, maybe I'm not done asking questions. But
so
again,
ask.
Pose
so
the
no,
question.
No, go ahead. Ask
now,
it. Because I bet you
pose the good question. Now go ahead. I definitely was going to ask it, but I'll just let you say whatever question I was going to ask.
Why would Microsoft be in favor of this, Andrew,
is what I was going to ask you.
And the answer is because the law provides both immunity to any company, meaning Microsoft or others that are the subject of valid warrants pursuant to this act, and a defense. And so I'm going to read a little bit from those provisions. It says, no cause of action against a provider disclosing information under this chapter. No cause of action shall lie in any court against any provider of a wire or electronic communication service, its officers, employees, agents, or other specified persons for providing information, facilities, or assistance in accordance with a court order under this chapter, request pursuant to a provision of this title, or an order from a foreign government that is subject to an executive agreement that the Attorney General has determined and certified to Congress satisfies the provisions for those executive agreements. And furthermore, good faith reliance on a court order under this chapter, a request pursuant to the Section 3125, legislative authorization, statutory authorization, or a good faith determination that the conduct complained of was permitted by an order from a foreign government that is subject to an executive agreement, is a complete defense against any civil or criminal action brought under this chapter or against or any other law. So what this means
is... I don't totally understand what that... Yeah, okay. So
it provides,
who's going to sue them for what?
It means if Microsoft turns over your data to a foreign government pursuant to this law, they have a complete defense against any civil action that you might bring against them. If they turn over data that is relevant to a state government, they have complete defense against any criminal action that could be brought by a state attorney general. So this absolutely immunizes anyone with access to your data from turning over that data in conjunction with this act. That's why the companies want it.
Okay. So there is, I imagine then this is something that's happening.
Why
is there a specific case or a lawsuit that that's
the Microsoft lawsuit, right? Like that's why Microsoft was not resisted turning over the Dublin data. It's not because Microsoft loves drug dealers, I don't think, anyway. And it's not because Microsoft doesn't want to cooperate with federal government investigation. It's because Microsoft was concerned if they turned over that data that they could be sued by individuals. Okay.
You know, that's funny. So I had just assumed that this was like an Apple San Bernardino situation where they were standing on their principles that they would never want there to be any backdoor into their, you know, into their iMessage or whatever it was with the terrorist. I was just assuming it was something like that where Microsoft just wouldn't have wanted to do this whatsoever. But it sounds like it's different where they didn't want to do it because they didn't want to get sued versus they didn't want to do it because it's some principled stand they're taking.
You could draw that inference, but that inference would be negated by their support for this bill.
Right? Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying.
Apple supported this bill. I mean, let's be clear on that as well. So, you know, liberal Apple with its principles, getting complete immunity from suit by statute is a pretty great concession. So, you know, I am not surprised. And, I can't say if I were Tim Cook, right? That's a pretty good, your duty is to your shareholders, and that's a pretty great concession to get in the law. So that's why the company's lined up behind it. But there we go.
Wow. So how scared should we be on this? Are you worried? How much data do we have stored in other country or stored here that other countries might want or vice versa?
So,
I
think what is coming, I would say that I don't know that I think that this is necessarily a tipping point or the straw that broke the camel's back. I take this in conjunction with, you know, our reporting on Cambridge Analytica, right? We have very little control over our private information. There are businesses where their entire model is the aggregation of that data. And so now what this does is provides yet another step, right? Where now foreign governments can get from a single location data that otherwise would be potentially difficult for them to aggregate together. So, you know, at some point, I mean, we've talked about this as a general social principle that the legal conception of privacy does not remotely match up with the way the world works today, right? Like we've talked about the whole, you know, have you thrown something away in your trash and taken the trash can out to the street, right? Like that's the analysis that a court uses to determine whether you have a reasonable expectation of privacy. Well, how does that begin to help you understand when, you know, your friend on Facebook plays a quiz designed by Cambridge Analytica to mine your data, right? Like it's just analogizing that to taking out the trash isn't helpful, doesn't answer the question. And so, you know, I think ultimately at the end of the day, like there will be a reckoning. We're going to have to rewrite our privacy law standards to conform to how people actually behave and where those actual risks are. So I know that's not
interesting.
I know that's not a full answer to your question, and I don't know that the question can be answered in kind of the individual. I think it's more about the aggregate, about what are we doing to protect things that we think of as being private that are not.
Yeah. All right. Well, there you have it. Andrew's breakdown of the movie Cloud Atlas. Thanks for that, Andrew.
Absolutely. Tom Hanks, greatest living actor.
Oh, you didn't know? Your ass better call!
Your lawyerly host, Andrew Torres.
All right, we've got a really good listener question. I love this one. I'm sure Andrew does as well. Ryan Backer, I think, asks, is the WWE illegally misclassifying their wrestlers as independent contractors rather than employees? If so, what has to happen to hold them accountable for it? I love it. Are they having them, you know, like, are they going to owe a bunch of overtime for, like, time spent in the, you know, in a headlock? I was in a headlock for like 15 minutes past when the whistle should have blown.
So let's answer the second half of that question first, right? What has to happen to hold them accountable for it? Something that is already happening, which is there is a pending class action lawsuit on behalf of WWE wrestlers against the WWE related to their classification as independent contractors. So the wheels are in motion. Now, the question is, you know, are wrestlers independent contractors?
I mean, there is the independent contractor, right? That's got to be one of the personas.
That would be, if I ever joined the WWE, that would be mine. I'd be... Now entering the ring, you know, 5'9" and 217 pounds is the independent contractor.
No, you'd be the belted lawyer, you'd be Mr. Belt and Suspenders lawyer is what you'd be, I think.
Maybe the independent contractor could be my finishing move, right? I'm gonna work on this one.
You've got him trapped in your suspenders, like two arms in the suspenders, and then you're like, I also have a belt. You use that and you grab him, and then you finish him with the independent contractor.
And then after
he's down, you know, I think you must have a briefcase. That's got to be part of it. You open it, and, yeah, like you put right. a you declare his death or something. You do something legal, you know, like so you execute his will. You know, like something like that.
Oh, this is great. Okay, we're going to work on this.
Why haven't they done this character? Now, the question is, though, when you inevitably do this, because you're definitely going to do it, right, will you be an actual independent contractor or not?
Here's the answer. I'm going to give the broad answer, and then we're going to drill down on a couple of different standards, right? So the broad answer, the general rule is that an individual is an independent contractor if the person paying him or her has the right to control or direct only the result of the work, not what will be done and how it will be done. Okay? So think about that classic independent contractor situation. I hire you to come paint my house, right? And the only thing I'm controlling there is that my house gets painted. You get to choose.
Are you able to give like a deadline? Like I need it painted by then?
Okay. Well, and that's where then you get into the specific applications of the standards, which I'll link in the show notes. But think about the general principle, right? When I hire you to paint my house, what I get to say is, hey, come paint my house. I'll pay you X amount. Finish it on or before Y date. But you get to figure out, are you going to bring one guy? Are you going to bring a whole team? Are you going to use power painting? You know, all of that stuff. The more I am micromanaging the way in which you're doing your thing, the more in which it looks like you're an employee and not an independent contractor.
So contrast that with like the guy who's painting your house has an employee and he's like, okay, can you do this over here, paint this part over here and be done. And, you know, directing them specifically on every aspect of it. That's more an employee relationship.
Exactly right. And so the IRS, for example, uses three different categories, right? Because we've just said, so the issue is control, but you know, look, it's not a binary question, right? And there is the short answer is the reason that there is litigation about this is because there isn't the president must be 35 level bright line rule here as to if you're over the bright line, you're automatically an employee. If you're on the other side, you're automatically an independent contractor. It's the interplay of factors. The question is control. So their three factors are behavioral control, right? And the IRS gives the examples of the types of instructions given, such as when and where to work, what tools to use, where to purchase supplies. Receiving these types of instructions indicate that a worker is likely to be an employee, right? The degree of instruction, the evaluative systems, right? How you measure performance, and training a worker how to do the job, or periodic or ongoing training about procedures and methods, is strong evidence to the IRS that a worker is an employee. Independent contractors ordinarily use their own methods, right? So that's one category. Another category is financial control. That is, does the business have the right to direct the financial and business aspects of the worker's job? So in other words, are they buying the tools and the paint, or are you bringing your own tools and paint, right?
Right.
Is there an opportunity for profit or loss? Is there a risk being undertaken? And then finally, the test that the IRS uses is relationship of the parties, right? So, and here, you know, you start with the baseline of if the parties have a contract and the contract says you're an independent contractor, that gives you a presumption. But the IRS says just having the contract is not sufficient to determine the worker's status. You have to look at, was this truly something that was negotiated, right? How permanent is the relationship? Can the independent contractor, can they terminate the relationship? Are you providing benefits as opposed to, just paying the money? And is the extent of the services provided a key aspect of the regular business of the company, or is it something that, you know, they are providing to benefit the company, but it's not the core company business? And I'm also going to link the Department of Labor fact sheet. But the bottom line on all of that is, I think when you look at all of those factors, almost all of them tend to favor the conclusion that WWE wrestlers are employees, not independent contractors.
Right. Yeah. It doesn't seem like that, you know, there's a lot of, it seems like it's almost got to be extremely spelled out in terms of everything they need to do all the time. You know, like it's an act. Like sorry if I just burst someone's bubble.
don't spoil it.
But it's like they, you know, this person has to win and that person's got to do this. You know, it seems like there's going to be a lot of very specific requests of your time and what you're doing, you know, for that. It's not like, I just need you to wrestle anytime this week, you know, like on your whenever you get it done, I need you to, you know, take on, I don't know any of the wrestlers, take on The Rock. No, it's kind of an old one.
Yeah, there's a guy right now. He's my current favorite WWE wrestler, and you can tell how often I watch because I don't know his name. But he he wrestles in jeans and he kind of looks like a hobo.
Maybe they create him specifically for this. Like, what if they did that? They create hired somebody to just be like the casual wrestler. Like he can, yeah, just anytime. Like the audience or no audience, you know, crowd just. Wherever you need to do it, just get the wrestling done. We just need the match done at some point. That's all.
Yeah. Yeah. He's great. And it's just, because remember, I grew up in the, you know, old WWF and like all of those, you know, larger than life, comically great, you know, Hulk Hogan, like, what you gonna do, brother? Like, I love that era. and to have like a guy kind of walk in, you know, in jeans and like a flannel shirt and like, you know, he's kind of got unkempt hair and he just sort of looks like a guy. I mean, he looks tough, but you know, he just sort of looks like a dude.
I don't know if he could take on the belt and suspenders lawyer though.
That'd be great.
We'll see. I can't wait. I'll buy that pay-per-view. I will.
Andrew get killed on pay-per-view. Yeah.
No, we need you for the show. But I randomly though, I think there's a new HBO, I want to say, documentary that's like Andre the Giant and Hulk Hogan, like that whole thing. I will watch that. So I'm not into WWE, but I will watch that because, you know, Andre the Giant and Hulk Hogan.
Yeah, I will watch that. And plug for The Running Man, maybe the greatest Schwarzenegger movie of all time, which has all of the stalkers in The Running Man are
I'm not sure how you could say that wrestlers. When True Lies exists because that is really a good movie, like a legitimately good movie, but
The Running Man is so good. So anyway, all right. So there you go. We have.
Are there any legal questions in The Running Man? Can we do that as a lawful movie? That would be fun.
It's the justice system. So absolutely.
Okay, we're doing it.
I suppose it's time we do a movie.
Yeah,
that
chime in, people.
That you're going to hate and I'm going to love because it's
it's stupid, but I want to watch it. I'm chime in if you think that's an appropriate movie for Lot Awful Movies. I mean, there's some law in there. But anyway, back to the question at hand. It sounds like your ultimate conclusion is that, you know, they're probably employees.
I think they are probably employees, and that is not to suggest, you know, there may be other defects in the class action lawsuit. We have talked about that before, you know, Rule 23's typicality requirement, all of that. I'm not opining that they're necessarily going to win damages and back pay and overtime and the like. But I think if they did, there could be
substantial.
Oh yeah,
costs,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. And I think, look, the real issue is, what is the IRS going to do? Is there any IRS enforcement? You may know that the McMahons are very, very close to Donald Trump. So, you know, I have no idea if the IRS is going to enforce any sort of determination there or conduct an investigation. But it seems pretty clear that they fall on the other side of the line. So there we go.
Wow. Yeah, interesting stuff. Great question. Thanks so much, Ryan, for that question. And now we've got to go to what is frankly, I mean, I'm just going to level with you guys, what is easily tied for top two segments of the week, and that is New Patron Tuesday.
New Patron Tuesday!
And we've got to thank our lovely new patrons who went over to patreon.com/law and decided, I want to get in on this really fun Lot Awful Movie stuff. Again, 2-for-1 deal on Lot Awful Movie this month. Thank you guys so much. Thank you to Thomas glances seductively at Andrew and licks his lips. Okay.
That's
sure.
It.
You
That's
pledge,
true.
So you get to say it. Yeah. Bird Lawyer 69, Diane King, Stephanie Miles, Jared Hart, Dwayne Newhart, Tanme Kulkarni, Hausdorf, Jeffrey Stewart, Ricard Bjorn. I don't know. Bjorn.
I think that rhimes with orange. So Bjorn.
Yeah. Bjorn. Brandon Price. Nemo Nobody. Jeffrey. Sith Lord Sexy Pants. Teresa Brandeburg. Marty Stites. Commissar Dixon. Kyle Bessing. Chris Ingersoll. Getting Off Podcast. Okay, cool. Sounds, check it out. And Stefan or Steven Lester, I never know which. It could be either, right?
Yeah,
usually Steven. I don't know. Steven Lester, thank
Give
you.
Give him two
so
shout outs. Steven and Stefan. Thanks to both of you.
His alter ego, Stefan.
And thanks to Danielle Wolford, Matthew Layden, Scott St. John, Michael Lysica, Jeffrey Gibbs. Thanks to Michael McGonigal, David Kakazd. Thanks to Lauren S., Laura Friedman, Willie Cecil. Thanks to Tiffany Forkner, Austin Nagy, Thomas. Yeah, good. Thanks for that.
Welcome.
Austin, I should point out, edited his name to Austin Nagy is sorry he was mean to Andrew on Twitter. So no, it's all good. It's all good, man. Angela Hansen, Adrian Mester, Gerald Sorko, Tom R., Kyle Horseman, AA, and our most recent pledge from Kenny Butts. So thanks to all of you for pledging over at patreon.com/law. We say this every Tuesday, but we truly couldn't do the show without your help. So thank you so much for supporting and making it possible for us to bring you the show.
Absolutely. Thank you, folks.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
And now it's time to find out, in last week's 15-minute dissertation I did on that question, how'd I do on TGB?
Yeah, so Thomas, this was a question about a supplier and a manufacturer. And this question is a uniform commercial code question, which is treated as its own separate unit.
Yes, the UCC.
Yeah, exactly. And since the only UCC law you know is from sovereign citizens, I think that it It was an impressive deliberation. So what happened? You have lumber supplier is supplying a contract to a furniture manufacturer for, quote, all the lumber that the manufacturer requires, end quote, over a 2-year period. The purchaser, the manufacturer, is super timely in all of his payments. And then there's one payment that it's not late, but he's used, you know, the guy's usually paying early. And all of a sudden there's a rumor going around that the furniture manufacturer is about to go bankrupt and isn't going to pay anymore. And the supplier says, hey, this seems like, usually pay within 10 days. It's been 15. Prove to me you're still good for this. And the furniture manufacturer sends over audited financial statements. It says, hey, look, we're fine. The supplier gets cold feet anyway, cancels the contract, and then the manufacturer sues for breach of contract. So number one, I think, as I said, on last week's show, you did a great job of kind of spotting all of the issues that were out there. You eliminated B and D. So let's talk about those first. B, the supplier had reasonable grounds for insecurity and was therefore entitled to cancel the contract and refused to make any future deliveries. Not answering the question of whether they were entitled to ask, they got audited financials. So yeah, B is the good, easy first elimination. It is not reasonable insecurities to say, no, I'm still scared after you've looked at audited financials that have said this company is in perfect health and you're just going based off of rumors.
Right.
You also eliminated D, yes, because the supplier was not entitled to condition resumption of deliveries on the receipt of financial status information. That's also a good elimination. Under the UCC, it's section 2-609, a party to a contract with reasonable grounds to worry that the other party might not perform can request adequate assurances of performance. And so it's perfectly reasonable for them to say, hey, look, I've heard a rumor you're going out of business. You usually pay in 10 days. It's been 15. What's going on? Prove to me you're still going to be good for this.
Seems reasonable. I mean, if you're supplying Enron with something and then
you see
some news reports, you shouldn't be required to like still deliver them a bunch of stuff.
That is exactly right. That's exactly why that provision is in there. So now the question is A correct, right? Is the contract unenforceable because it does not contain a defined term? Because it just says, I will sell you anything you require. And the answer is, it is perfectly permissible under UCC 2-306 for a contract to provide a term that measures the quantity by the requirements of the buyer. And so, yeah, you can enter into a contract that says, yeah, I'm going to be your supplier. And if you think about that, think about how the business world operates. There are plenty of situations where, particularly a manufacturer will have variable requirements, you know, over a particular period of time, right? You know, you get a lot of orders for furniture, you need more wood, you get fewer, you need less wood. And rather than forcing people to specify a number, a contract must be definite enough that it's capable of being performed. So then the question is it definite enough to say, yeah, we'll be your supplier. We'll give you all you need. And the UCC said, yeah, we want to encourage those kinds of contracts. So that means A is incorrect, which means you chose C. C is in fact correct. Yes, because the report and audited financial statements provided adequate assurance of due performance under the contract. Yeah. So the supplier was perfectly within their rights to request information, but the purchaser gave them the information and they were not then entitled upon receiving the information to say, we're still scared. So, you know, too bad, we're going to cancel this contract. That's breach of contract. And so
four in a row, 40 for 70. Nice round numbers there. I like it. Wow.
Very excited.
Yeah, it's interesting though. What are the implications on that for if you need more lumber than a supplier even has? How does that, I mean, would that then be grounds to like terminate a contract? If it's like, okay, this contract says all I need double what you even have. Therefore, would they be able to just back out of it?
I want to do a deeper dive into that specific question. So I'm going to postpone it. It's absolutely a real question that comes up
I was going to also ask, and we can of course postpone it, but then would you only be allowed to do like one of these? You know, like if you have two contracts where it's, or more, where it's like all that they need, it would be interesting to balance that. Who gets, you know, who gets the goods if you only have a finite amount? But okay, we'll look into that more later.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, the important thing is I'm killing it at the bar. That's what I'm taking away.
That is the important from all this thing. I agree.
Yeah. All right. I was a little worried, you know, that there's some stuff, but overall it was the reasonable answer. So I'm sure plenty of people got this right. And therefore, I'm sure if you hop in your time machine future, Andrew Torres, you'll have a great answer to pick from for this week's winner.
Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice.
Well, Thomas, as it turns out, nobody won this week. Fair number of people played on Facebook and Twitter, but I didn't see anybody else get the correct answer. So let this be a lesson to you out there. If you're sitting there thinking, I know TTTBE, I know the answer. It's definitely C. Thomas is definitely right. You gotta play to win. So this week, for the first time since the show really began, no winners on Twitter. And let that be a lesson to you folks.
All right. Well, thanks so much for listening, everybody. It's been another great episode, another great week, and looking forward to seeing you on Friday for a rapid response. We'll see you on Friday. Thanks, everybody.
Until then.
You betray the law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the help of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, production assistant, Natalie Newell, and our unofficial researcher, Magpie. A special thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Natalie, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, and Emily Waters. And also thanks to Thomas Smith, who wrote and produced all of the amazing music you hear, which is used with his permission.